Good morning. Welcome to the Life Matters Friday Talkback on ABC Radio National. Richard Adie with you. Today, a feature-length discussion with someone who's been measuring the Australian mind and mood for decades now. What makes us tick? The 10 desires that drive us is the latest offering from the psychologist and social researcher and writer Hugh McKay. Over the next hour, we're going to be pulling apart some of the 10 areas Hugh's examined to find out what you might have to say about them as well. Shortly, we'll be talking about the desire for my place, the one I think we can all relate to, the desire to be taken seriously, I reckon. Have a think about these. Is there a particular place that's fundamentally yours where you feel most at ease? It could be somewhere at home. It could be somewhere not at home, actually. It could be at work. It could be in the car. That's something we'll touch on later. Also, on the being taken seriously, do you think you're taken seriously enough? I reckon most of us don't feel we are. The number to call is 1-300-22-55-76. 1-300-22-55-76. 1-300-CALL-RN, if that's easier to remember. If you can't take part due to time differences, leave a comment on the listener line, and that, of course, is 02-833-1430. And you can put a comment right now on the website at abc.net.au/rn/lifematters, or use the Facebook page if you prefer. Hugh McKay's with me in the studio. Welcome back to Life Matters, Hugh.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Now, this isn't based on social research. This is, I think, almost the first one of your non-fictions that isn't. It's come from somewhere else.
It has, although, of course, my social research keeps intruding, and I quote many of my respondents over the years. I quote them through the book. But no, it's not a work of social research. It's a work, really, of psychology. It's a study of the psychology of human motivation, which certainly draws on my own work, but draws on my basic training as a psychologist, the writing of many other people, other people's research, and also, as readers of the book will discover, a lot of personal reflection as well.
Yes, and there's a lot of what you've heard when listening to people, whether in, I imagine, the social research or just eavesdropping.
Eavesdropping on a bus or around the family dinner table. Various members of my extended family will recognise themselves in the book, but luckily no one else will.
Right, okay. You're exploring some very fundamental ideas about who we are as individuals. Do you think that this is a kind of a trend in itself, the way we're trying to make sense of things more and more?
Yes, I do, but I think it's perhaps not something that's unique and contemporary. I mean, I think we go through periods for various socio-cultural, economic, other reasons. Through history, we go through periods of being quite deeply reflective about who we are, what it's all about. I mean, the ancient Greeks were into this in a very big way, and I quote some of them as well. But I think we're in one of those phases now. I think that's correct. In the present phase, I think, to be a social researcher for one moment, it's a very direct reaction to rising levels of anxiety associated with the rate of change, that the world just keeps changing so quickly, whether we're talking about technology or politics or economics or terrorism or whatever we're talking about, or the marriage rate or the birth rate or the shrinking household. You know, all of these things are disruptive. And when we're in that kind of phase, it's very human for us, very natural for us to look inwards and see what kind of what resources we have for making sense of this, making sense of ourselves. You know, it's the kind of period when a lot of people, I suppose people have always said this, but particularly in a turbulent time, we say, you know, why did I do that? We find ourselves behaving in ways that even to ourselves are quite hard to explain.
Well, we normally find a way of explaining things, even if it's not really believable to anyone else.
Well, we rationalise things, yes.
So 10 social desires, and we'll get through most of them today, I think, but introduce us to the idea.
The idea is that we are caught in a web of desire, that there are many competing, overlapping, often conflicting desires, all clamouring for our attention. The desire to be taken seriously always wants to be satisfied. So does the desire for love. So does the desire for control. And that's an interesting pair. You know, the desire for love and the desire for control are almost always in competition with each other and cause a lot of angst for all concerned. So my sense of it is that we have this set of desires swirling around inside us, all wanting to win. And at any given moment, probably two or three or maybe four can be satisfied, and the others are jumping up and down impatiently, feeling frustrated and causing feelings of frustration or anger or irritation. But therefore, there is never a single explanation for anything we do. One of the most insensitive questions we ever ask each other is, why did you do that? As though there's a reason, a rational explanation, but also as though there's one explanation, you know, as though you must have done that for a reason. Well, if we could be reflective
I said
enough,
this to my child, to my son last night, actually. I'm sure I said, why did you do that to him?
Yes. Perhaps you might develop the habit of saying, which of the following 10 desires?
Here's a list.
But, you know, when you look at, for example, why some people are passionate religious believers, you know, that's not just because of the desire to believe. In fact, for many people, religion ticks all 10 boxes, and the reason why they believe is because all these desires are satisfied. Why did you marry this woman or buy that car or vote for that candidate? There are going to be a lot of reasons. Why did this young couple who love each other decide to get married? Well, you could say, well, they married for love, but perhaps they believe in the institution of marriage. Perhaps they think they will be taken more seriously as a couple if they marry. Perhaps there'll be a deeper sense of connection if they marry. And there might be some murky motives as well.
On Life Matters today, it's Friday Talkback. We're keen to hear from you. We're exploring Hugh McKay's ideas on what makes us tick. So what desires drive you? How do your desires affect your decisions in life? And desires in the broader sense of the word, so not just who you lust after or who you fancy or what you like to eat. Do you think you're taken seriously enough? And if you are, how does that affect your well-being? Because I think those two things are very connected. And where's home for you? Where is your place? Can you name that? It might, if you think about it hard, it might be not what you immediately expect. Can you name your top desire? 1-300-22-55-76 is the number. 1-300-CALL-RN. Get weaving to beat the time difference if you're in the Northern Territory or South Australia. My guest, as I mentioned, is Hugh McKay. Let's talk about this desire to be taken seriously. I think it kicks the book off, and I think it's a very important one, one I hadn't thought of at all. What happens when you're not taken seriously or feel you're not?
Well, I'm glad you reacted to it as you did, because I describe in the book as the sovereign desire. I think, you know, I don't think the others are in any order of importance, but I think this one is fundamental, because it really goes to whether we feel we belong here, you know, whether we're acknowledged. Our whole sense of identity rests on people taking us seriously, acknowledging us, noticing us, treating us as unique, and so on. If we're not taken seriously, the reaction, the consequences can be very bad for us. Some people who in childhood have felt humiliated or belittled or abused, all of which are ways of not taking someone seriously, carry those things as wounds through their entire life and never feel as though they are worthy of being taken seriously, which, of course, is a walking tragedy, a person who feels like that. Some react in the opposite way. I remember, I quote in the book, Ken Maroney, the former New South Wales Police Commissioner, who was told early in his career by a supervising officer, "You'll never amount to anything, Maroney." Well, he could have been crushed by that, but the measure of the man is he became police commissioner. And many people who are, you know, stars in sport or show business or the arts or business will say, you know, I was put down and I was determined to prove them wrong. But that's very heroic. And that's possible for some people, but most people who are put down don't respond.
No, indeed.
They feel crushed by it. Young people who take to drugs in a pathological way are often reacting to the sense that they have not been taken seriously. Mm. People who become reclusive, people who become arrogant, bullies. This is almost always the sign of someone who, at some level, often in childhood, was not taken, felt that they were not taken seriously enough.
And on a much bigger sort of scale, you note the trend for pushing for official apologies, which we've started to have in Australia. That's part of the same thing, you argue.
Precisely, another symptom of it. Groups of people, whether Indigenous people or children abused in institutions or whatever other category people might belong to, saying, as a category, it was as if we didn't exist. People didn't acknowledge what we'd been through. They haven't acknowledged who we are. And the apology, I mean, many people have been rather cynical, rather sceptical about apologies. Well, what does that achieve? Well, of course, what it achieves is it puts you on the radar. It says, yep, we acknowledge you, we take you seriously. And that of itself, quite apart from what else might follow, that of itself is a huge reassurance. I mean, people who feel as though, I quote the case of a woman, in fact, in the book, who says she lost her voice in her marriage. She felt submerged in marriage, though she was only ever regarded as part of the family, not as an individual in her own right. She felt she wasn't being taken seriously. People who apply for jobs and don't have their application even acknowledged. It was as if I didn't exist.
You also, and this is something else I had not thought of at all, you say this explains why minorities thrive when they're persecuted.
Because people are taking them seriously. The most tragic aspect of that, of course, is people, and they tend mainly to be women, who remain in abusive relationships, even physically abusive relationships, because at least he's not ignoring me. I mean, it's kind of tragically pathetic to hear someone say that, and yet you can understand the psychology of it, as with the minorities who are persecuted. They thrive under persecution, and it's partly because at last someone is paying attention.
And speaking of paying attention, we pay a lot of attention, ridiculous amounts of attention really, to celebrities. I have often wondered why we care, apart from the fact that many of them are very decorative. But you think it's about this as well?
I do. I think there are lots of aspects of human behaviour can be explained in terms of this desire, and that is one. Why do we kind of, not exactly worship at the altar of celebrity, but we're bedazzled. We buy all these glossy magazines and crash up against
them. Speak for yourself. I only look at them when I go to the dentist.
Ah, of course, yes. Yes, I get a remarkable amount of news at home after a visit has been made by my wife to the hairdresser. I think the key to this fascination we have with celebrity is, here is someone really being taken seriously, even though they're not particularly worthy of it necessarily. You know, they might be, their personal lives might be a shambles and so on, but look how seriously they are being taken. Is there a clue for me? Is there something there that I can take out of this that might help me to be taken? It's a fantasy. I think, for example, the current fashion for weddings, which are like celebrity occasions, with the full video recording and, you know, the bride overdressed and, you know, the whole thing staged as if on a movie set, I think is people borrowing the idea of celebrity in order to be guaranteed that at least on this day we'll be taken seriously. It's the same reason why we love birthday parties. We say we hate them, but we love them because, people are acknowledging me. People are remembering me. They're even perhaps celebrating me.
Yes. On Life Matters today, Friday Talk Back, we're talking about what makes us tick, what desires matter most. What matters most to you? What do you think about Hugh McKay's talking about being taken seriously? Is this an issue for you? And the desire for home. Where's home? It may not be your house or your city. We're going to talk about that. Home is not necessarily where many of us feel most at home.
Yes. true. I think the desire for my place is a bit different from the desire for home, although you could almost interchange the terms. But yes, we do seem to have a visceral need for a place that defines us, a place that somehow gives us a sense of, certainly of comfort, security, reassurance, but also identity. And it's surprising to me, I have studied this in research over the years, and it's surprising, excuse me, how often people talk about their special place as either not being at home at all, but maybe a seat in a particular coffee shop or a corner of their office or their car. But even if it is home, it's often a home within the home. It's the den, or it's the kitchen, or it's the shed, or whatever it might be.
Well, let's take a caller now. Adrian in Queensland. Because, Adrian, good morning.
Good morning.
Your sense of home is not at home at all.
Most of the time, it's definitely not at home, no.
So where are you when you get it, or what are you doing?
Well, yes, oddly enough, my home is on my bicycle going around a certain corner.
Yeah?
There's just sheer balance in this particular corner. Also, another place of home for me is sitting on an inflatable kayak on the river on a sort of sunny day. There's just moments of sheer bliss for me.
Yes.
You know, there's a light.
Where you're absolutely in the moment.
In the moment, as it is.
Yeah. So how long has that been so?
Oh, well, I've been riding bikes since I can't remember when I wasn't riding a bike, but I'm now 73. So it's a long time.
Right.
But particularly now I'm fairly capable of riding a bike reasonably well, I suppose, after all those years. But it's the balance of it or something. It's an element I can't explain.
It's a balance and space.
In the moment.
And in the moment that we mentioned. And that, I guess that sense of almost freedom.
Freedom and joy, possibly.
Yeah. It's. Have you heard this kind of thing before?
I have. I love these two examples that we're now listening to. The bike, that says to me, this is a moment when I feel as if I'm who I really am. This is about identity as much as the sense of my place. And the kayak example is beautiful for the same reason, but also because it goes to another of our basic human desires, which is the desire to connect at various levels, but including to connect with the natural world. I've heard various people on this program over the last couple of months talking about the need for kids, for example, to get out into the bush and be connected with the natural world. The gardening revolution is a symptom of the same thing, and so is our caller sitting on his kayak having that moment, not just of this place is somehow defining me, but this place is connecting me. I've heard surfers say this quite often. You know, you feel there's a kind of a universality about this experience. I'm somehow connected with the cosmos, and that's hugely liberating and therapeutic.
Adrian, I feel that we should let you go so you can go and get out on your bike or on the river.
Absolutely, yes.
Thank you very much for that.
My pleasure, absolutely.
Thanks for kicking us off. And if you want to make a contribution, 1-300-22-55-76 is the number. Where do you feel that it's your place? And interesting there that where our first caller, Adrian, was talking about his place, it's in a way, it's almost not a place. It's a kind of moment, although it is a particular corner or on the kayak in the river. The car, you've already touched on this. I couldn't relate at all to it when I read it. I'm very utilitarian about the car, but for some people, it's clearly more than that.
Oh, yes. You're in a tiny minority.
Oh, really?
If you're utilitarian about the car, Richard. I would almost say the eccentric fringe.
Oh, okay.
No, it's a symptom of the contemporary world. I mean, we are a highly mobile society. Speed, pace, change, movement, stimulation, this is the colour of our lives at the moment. So it doesn't strike me as all that surprising that I hear so many people saying, the place where I feel most at home is in my car. I must say that it tends to be more male than female, this response. But it's as though it's a cocoon where you're mostly in the car on your own, and that's part of it, of course, and the car defines us. We choose the cars we own and drive, and they say something about us, including some things we don't want to have said. But they do say something about us because they express our aesthetic and other preferences. But I think it's more to do with the enclosed space that's my space, and also being hand on the wheel, foot on the accelerator. Yeah. I'm in control.
That's the other one.
As much as this is my own space.
We'll come to control a bit later. But I want to ask you about something, because you tell a story about yourself in this sense of place, about when you visit Scotland, where you are not from, but your ancestors are from, and this sense of it being your place.
Yes, absolutely absurd and weird while it was happening, but very powerful. And I've heard other people say the same thing. I was on a train travelling from London to Edinburgh and crossing the border and realising this is Scotland and feeling, well, I've come home. It's completely absurd. I mean, the last...
And you loved all of it. So the borders country and Edinburgh and...
Had nothing to do with where my family had actually come from. It was Scotland in my imagination that became Scotland in reality. And I locate... Because I've always thought of myself as of Scottish descent, being there, it was almost mystical in its power, this sense of... This is my place. This is where I belong. And I really did feel utterly at home there, which was crazy, except I now hear many other people saying similar things.
Now, you're at pains in this book to point out that these desires, they're mostly value-free. So there's sort of good and bad to it. And one of the bad aspects to this is that, it certainly feels like a bad aspect, is the rise of the gated community. You think that's connected to this, don't you?
I do. Yes, again, a combination of desires at work, but the desire for my place very powerfully expressed. Let's lock ourselves in. This is our place and others can't come in. It's also, of course... A misplaced, in my view, there's a judgment, but a misplaced expression of the desire for control. If we can put up a fence and have a gate and lock everyone else out, our environment will be under control and we'll feel as though our lives are more under control.
Yeah.
I think this turns out to be very hollow. I mean, people who think that they'll feel more in control if they put bars on the window and have a security gate... typically feel less secure than before they did all that, because these things are constant reminders of their insecurity.
This is we had Lenore Scanese on yesterday of the free range kids movement, and she was saying that in America, where it's worse than here, the paranoia about children, there's a big movement to give them GPSs so you know you can check in on where they are all the time. This does not, it turns out, make you feel better about it. It makes you feel worse.
Exactly. Oh, yes. But it's the desire for control gone mad.
All right. In a moment on Life Matters, we're going to talk about a few more desires. Desire for something to believe in. Desire to be useful. I mean, can you think of a more pejorative term than that someone's useless? I don't think I can. Do either of these things strike a chord with you? I can relate to both. But let's take some more calls now. And I think probably on the idea of my place, Cheryl in Victoria. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, for you, it's a being near the beach, isn't it?
Well, yes, but not necessarily the beach. For me, it's being in my camper trailer. I have a Jayco camper trailer with the beds, the canvas beds that come out the end.
We had one of those when I was a kid, actually. I thought it was brilliant.
I absolutely love it. Oh, the little beds, I feel like it's a cave. It's my little cave. It's particularly lovely. I camped at Byron Bay where I could lie on my little bed, and I actually had a sea view at a fraction of the cost of, and a lot less cleaning. You know, it's so tiny, there's not a lot of housework to do, so you can spend more time on the beach. But whether it's in National Park or anywhere, I just, being in that, and I feel very safe, even though it's only canvas walls, but I just feel very at home in my little... tent on wheels.
Well, good on you. I reckon more people will ring and talk about that kind of thing after hearing your story, Cheryl. Thank you for that. Now, Terry, in Queensland, you want to talk about drawing of all things.
Yeah.
Now, is that where you feel is your place, or is it something different, do you think?
Well, I can sort of create my place where I go with my drawing, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. I just discovered drawing about 5 or 6 years ago, and I feel very relaxed when I draw. I feel very comfortable, and I feel like I can take my world with me in a sort of a way. That was the resonance I was getting when I was hearing you and Hugh talk before.
Yeah. Hugh, what do you think else is coming into drawing?
Yes, this is a fascinating example because, again, we're looking at a number of desires that have come together, I suspect, in this moment.
You're also very positive about people having the arts in their lives.
Exactly. I think this is at least two things operating here. The sense of a place that is created. Again, there's almost like a cocooning, like the camper van, the trailer, almost a cocooning by the act of drawing. You're now in your artist's bubble. And so this is a portable place. As long as you've got your pen and sketch pad, that's your place. But it's also this wonderful thing that all of us desire, the desire to connect with ourselves, to understand ourselves better. And creative self-expression turns out to be, in some ways, the easiest and most productive, even compared with meditation and counselling and all of these other things which have great value. But all of us can get to a new and stronger sense of connection with who we are by drawing, singing, painting, dancing, taking photographs, etc. Yeah. Carl Rogers, who's my personal psychological hero, an American psychotherapist.
Yep.
Ah, you know him also, yes.
Yeah.
Well, he said, reflecting on 50 years of clinical practice, he said there is only one problem, by which he meant that whatever his clients presented to him as their problem, it always came down to the question, who am I, really? And I think what you're saying to me, I hope I'm not over-interpreting, but one of the things I get from this is that when you're drawing, you are expressing yourself. This is very much a communication with you, and that would be a very therapeutic experience.
Yes, and I think for me, while I can go into a little door, like playing music, you go into a private little room, and that's what drawing's like for me, but I'm also connecting with a tree or with my community, whatever I'm drawing. So it gives me that double feeling, which is beautiful. And that's what Merleau-Ponty said, didn't he, that when you paint, when you look at the landscape looks back at you.
Yes,
that's beautiful stuff. So anyway,
Thanks very much for that, Terry.
Yeah, thank you.
We've also got somebody, Pete's written in on the email. He says, home's not always a place, it's a circumstance, an environment. And I think this is what he was getting at when he says it's about my place. I often feel home when I recall my wife and daughter walking on the beach in Rarotonga. Home is bliss. So that's terrific. Let's talk about the desire for something to believe in. This is something that preoccupies many of us. And it's not because we're not as religious a country as we used to be. So although some people
depending how you define religion.
Yeah, but people are turning to alternatives, everything from astrology all the way to modern personal development programs here.
Mm. Yes, I think the desire to believe in something is absolutely innate. I think we are born believers. The burgeoning field of neuroscience, which spooks me slightly because they're finding out so much stuff about what goes on in the human mind, I'm wondering if the profession of psychology will gradually disappear, be replaced by neuroscience. But some recent, unfortunately so recent I couldn't include it in the book, some recent UK research has shown that just in terms of the cognitive process, the effort, the brain fag involved, it's much easier to believe than to be sceptical.
So that explains why we're much happier. We're not comfortable with ambiguity.
No.
We want certainty.
Skepticism does not become us. You know, we're not comfortable with that. We're not comfortable with ambiguity. We like simple certainty. We like the black and white choices, which explains, of course, the rise of fundamentalism, not just in religion, but in economics and environmentalism and so on. But the desire to believe, I'm sure, has been with us from the beginning. We've, in a sense, and of course, religion, one of the obvious expressions of this, is not just about the desire to believe. It's also about the desire for control. One way of feeling as though you can control what's happening is to interpret it, to have a kind of template you can lay over things. And belief gives us that. When people read the Da Vinci Code in their millions, they thought...
I didn't, I have to say, but go on.
I didn't either. We should form a club, Richard. We're the only two Australians who never read
it. It takes effort not to read the Da Vinci Code, it turns out. Your brain's working hard and not doing it.
That's right.
If you want to work out, just ignore it completely.
But when people read it, a lot of people said, well, here's the answer. You know, all right, so this gives them... They treated it as though it was non-fiction because it seemed to explain to them things about the Roman Catholic Church or whatever it was. And we love that. We love conspiracy theories.
We do.
You mentioned astrology. I mean...
I wish I hadn't, but it is there.
Well,
people read them.
In Western societies, and this is not just a book about Australia, this is really a book about the West. In Western societies, wherever you go, the figures are almost identical. About between 30 and 35% of people say they believe in astrology. Now, we'd have to explore what they mean by believe, but I'll bet you know your star sign.
Well, I don't believe it, but that's because I'm borderline Capricorn Aquarius. we're quite sceptical. I like you. There's some lovely quotes in this book, Hugh, and one you've included is from Chesterton, and Chesterton said, "When people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing; they believe in anything."
And I think
what an insight that was.
Yeah, we all believe in something. Even people who say I'm a skeptic believe in skepticism. You know, there are people who believe in the free market. There are people who believe in rationality as the altar they should worship at, etc. We've all got something that's not rational. It's not rational to believe in rationality because when you look at human behaviour, so much of it is non-rational. So what's that about? But we cling to these things which help us to find our way through, to make sense of the journey by some kind of a frame of reference, I suppose, is another way of putting it. And it doesn't seem to matter what it is, how loopy it is, or how rational it is. It gives us the guidebook. It gives us the code for interpreting what's going on around us.
On Life Matters today, Friday Talkback, we're talking about what makes us tick, the 10 desires that drive us, with Hugh McKay, who's written a book on this very series of topics. And shortly we're going to be talking about usefulness, what makes you feel useful, because it's a very powerful desire. And I think certainly in Australia, and I think the UK too, from when I lived there, being useless is pretty much the worst thing you can be. So start thinking about that. But we are still getting lots of people wanting to talk about the desire for my place. It's really resonating. Let's hear a few more on that now. Virginia in Sydney. Hello.
Yes, hello there.
Now, for you, it's about music, isn't it?
That's right.
What particular form?
Well, chamber music, I suppose the great Schumann, Schubert, Mendelssohn, Beethoven, Shostakovich and so on. And I just adore this music, and when I'm in the concert hall, I just turn off. I'm just totally at home with the music.
It is. I think music's the greatest of the art forms, Hugh, and it does have this transformative effect on people, doesn't it?
No doubt. Absolutely no doubt about that. And for people who are music lovers, a concert hall is like a sacred site. It's like a cathedral for religious believers and the MCG for AFL enthusiasts and so on. No doubt that the sense of my place doesn't have to be personal. It doesn't have to be my own bubble or cocoon. It can be quite a public place where I really feel myself. And of course, there are again other desires that overlap with that, like the desire to belong to the tribe of like-minded people
who are gathered here as well. Thanks, Virginia. Now, John, you're actually our last caller on the sense of my place, because we're going to move on to this idea of usefulness and other things as well. But you live on the edge of somewhere beautiful.
Yeah, I live on the edge of the rainforest, and up to the age of 85,
Yes.
I'm 73 now. I lived on a tea plantation in Assam, India, surrounded by jungle.
That is very beautiful, that part of the world.
Yeah, you do, huh?
No, it's a very beautiful part of the world,
Diane. Very beautiful, and the people were beautiful to us, too.
Right.
But what I'd like to say is, on the philosophical side of it, control or being taken seriously and everything. Most of us would rather be loved or seek to be loved rather than to love. Now, all these things actually come from the ego, not from the heart. Can I just make two quick quotes?
Very quick, because we've got a full board, I'm afraid.
Okay, one was Hermann Hesse, and he said, there is no reality except the one contained within you. That is why so many people lead such an unreal life. They take the images outside themselves as reality and never allow the world within to assert itself.
And
the second one, Jesus was about kingdom of heaven. I've been told that heaven comes from the word harmony. He said, the kingdom of God does not come with observation, nor will they say, see here or see there. For indeed, the kingdom of heaven or harmony is within you.
All right. Thank you very much for that, John. John, with a couple of points there to make on what we're talking about, what makes us tick. 1-300-22-55-76 is the number. There are actually now one or two lines available. If you can't get through, though, 0-2-8-3-3-14-30 is the number. Let's talk about this desire to be useful, Hugh. As I said, I think being useless is one of the worst things that we think that you can be. A desire to be useful underpins work for many of us, doesn't it?
Yes, and work is a beautiful textbook case of how many desires might come together in one activity. But it is intriguing to see how many people continue working at jobs they don't like, or continue working after they no longer need to work, or seek voluntary work after they retire. And why do they do it? Lots and lots of reasons, but the fundamental one there is, well, the combination of the desire to be useful,
yes,
and the desire to be taken seriously, because
yes,
people feel
I
as though I'll be a less serious person if I haven't got some kind of function in society.
Those two things together give purpose.
Yes.
People want purpose.
Absolutely right. And as you say, the word useless, it's a very common story. A study I did some years ago on retirement, people who'd recently retired, threw up a lot of this stuff about the desire to be useful. I remember a particular case, again, quoted in the book, of a wife saying, you know, he retired and he was just kicking around the house and painted the house like everyone does when they retire. Eventually I said to him, why don't you do something useful? Because, of course, he was feeling useless. And he went off and started doing reading, coaching at the local primary school and so on. And he was a new man. The sense that we are useless is a very hollow, very corrosive sense.
Now, this is the sense that I have when I encounter tradesmen, people who know what they're doing. My father was an extremely practical, skilled man, and I'm not. And you actually found that tradespeople have a kind of psychological advantage.
Yes, yes, yes. Those of us who work in cerebral pastimes, I think, have a huge disadvantage. You can say, I'm writing a book, but yes, well, show us the pile of pages. Well, I didn't actually write anything today. There's a wonderful story about Alan Bennett, one of my favourite British writers, and again, I quoted in the book, Bennett saying that he had discovered a way to waste 10 minutes when he was writing, and this was to remove the lint from his washing machine filter, and that gave him a great sense of achievement. He could go off and do that as well as distracting himself from the writing task. But writers, broadcasters,
yes,
you know, people in these sort of jobs, I think, do suffer from a terrible sense of envy when we see someone build a house or unblock a drain.
I can do drains,
all that sort of thing. But there is something enormously therapeutic in the task completed where there's tangible evidence.
Yes,
I mean, there are a few moments for a writer to compare with the moment when you first hold the printed book, and now suddenly all the talk about what you've been doing is translated into a tangible piece of evidence that you are useful. Even an activity as ephemeral as teaching, which is an enormously important but very difficult, almost mysterious process, the process of education. Now, of course, in this era where everything has to be measured and boxes have to be ticked, even teachers' usefulness is going to be more harshly assessed, like the feedback of students will be taken into account in deciding how useful, how effective a teacher is. That's a symptom of the age.
On Life Matters today, we are talking about what makes us tick with Hugh McKay. 1-300-22-55-76, if you can get through. Let's have Glenda in Melbourne. You've got a new job that fulfills your desires. Yeah?
Absolutely. Good morning, Richard and Hugh, and I must be the third person who didn't read the Da Vinci Code.
Oh, good on you. We'll get a club going. We may get to double figures.
I'm just about to turn 68, And for financial reasons, I have to work. Mm. And I have been very lucky to find a job that gives me recognition. It's something I can believe in. I feel useful because I'm helping to raise money for people in developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being taken seriously and it gives me a purpose. So what else can I need?
No, that does seemingly tick a lot of boxes.
And it probably also provides you with a group to belong to that satisfies that desire
to
belong.
And it gives me a place.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
Apart from my car.
Thank you very much, Glenda.
Okay.
Actually, we're going to talk more about the desire to belong, because herds and tribes, I hadn't thought of it in these terms before, so you should think about that. Think about whether you're in a herd. Of course you are. You'll quickly find you're in a herd. You're also going to be perhaps in several tribes, which is definitely worth touching on this weekend, in which there's more football than anyone could possibly imagine. How do these different groupings work, Hugh? And you should reveal your bias straight away. You're a herd man.
I'm a herd man, yeah. And I'm very uncomfortable about tribal behaviour, yeah, because often the ugliest aspects of human behaviour are driven by the desire to belong to tribes, whether they're sporting or commercial or national. Tribalism has got us into all kinds of difficulty. It breeds triumphalism, arrogance, war, etc.
It can be very enjoyable when you're at the football.
It can be quite harmless. And symbolic versions of war are greatly to be preferred to the real thing. It's important, I think, to recognise that we are social creatures. That's the nature of humans. Our default position is together. Now, most of us love a bit of isolation, a bit of solitude at times. But our default position is that we're social creatures. We love this sense of being connected to the little herds, typically 5 to 8 people in a herd. If you look at human history, that's what a herd tends to be. And the tribe. And all of us do, whether we like it or not, we do belong to tribes of one kind or another. But we are defined by these herds and these tribes, and many of our psychological needs are satisfied by the sense of being connected. It's to do with being acknowledged, being taken seriously by these other people.
So a herd is about the people you know and interact with often and regularly.
Yes.
A tribe's about something bigger,
yes,
about identity.
Yes, some larger sense that you identify with. It might be, you know, I'm an Anglican, for example. Well, but I probably belong, if I were an Anglican, I might belong also to a little herd in a local church community. Or I might say I'm a liberal. I belong to that tribe, but I might belong to a branch that gives me a herd, or just a group of people with like-minded political views. Often the workplace provides us with a very strong herd to belong with. There's a Life Matters herd with very strong close connections. You work as a team, but there's an ABC tribe.
Yes.
And you belong to that as well. And the herds within the ABC may often be in conflict with each other. But if it's a question of defending the ABC against some outside tribe, of course, suddenly we'd all be ABC tribespeople.
Yes, march in the streets next time the government says it wants to take money off us people. We should have an ABC tribe, actually, with colours and everything. Let's take Jackie next. She's in Victoria. Jackie, you feel... Damn, we've lost Jackie. I was just going to ask her a question. Well, look, I'll ask you about something else. Because one of the other desires that I want to talk about is the desire for something to happen.
Mm.
And you've identified a paradox here.
Yes.
Because we crave stability. We want constancy. But we also rail against it.
Yes. It is a paradox. And again, I think it's one of these things that quite fundamentally explains a lot of apparently irrational human behavior. Yes, on the one hand, we say we want security, we want stability, we complain that things are changing too quickly. In fact, we can have rising levels of anxiety provoked by the rate of social change, for example, or the challenge of technological revolutions, all this sort of stuff. Yeah, we say we resist that. Yet, we also say, I just feel like doing something different. I need a change. I need to break out. And of course, Those two voices are equally authentic because as humans we do need some stability, some constancy in our lives, especially emotional constancy. We need the sense of being securely loved by someone. But as humans who are alive and alert, we need the challenge of constant newness. As babies, we thrive on, I mean, we're bored in a moment. We thrive on new faces, new things. You know, you've explored this space and you need to move to another space. And when we lose that, that's when we start to atrophy. I mean, there's a lot of talk now about the brain that, what's the Norman Doidge book, the brain that renews
brain
itself
that
or
changes
something?
Itself. Yeah.
Changes itself, yes. The whole idea of brain plasticity, that's very much associated with being exposed to constant freshness. People say, look, I'm keeping dementia at bay by doing a crossword every day. Well, that's terrific for the first week while you're learning how to do it, and then it's not achieving.
No, then
you've
got
to be doing new challenging things, and the unexpected needs to crash into our lives to keep us alert.
You quote P.G. Woodhouse on this, it's wonderful, and he says, when some outstanding disaster happens to the ordinary man, it finds him prepared. Years of missing the 8:45, taking the dog for a run on rainy nights, endeavouring to abate smoky chimneys and coming down to breakfast and discovering they've burned the bacon again, have given his soul a protective hardness, so that by the time his wife's relations arrive for a long visit, he is ready for them.
I'm glad you read that. It's one of my favourite P.G. Woodhouse quotes, and I think it's the best part of the book, and I wish I had written it. But it does capture this this point that it's only by disasters, disappointments, failures, suffering,
the grit in the oyster kind of thing.
All of that is what gives us the equipment to deal with the things that life throws at us. But not only that, it is what keeps us fresh, alert, alive, young. There's a Harvard psychologist, Jerome Kagan, who's written extensively on this, and I quote him in the book, and he says all of the psychology that came from B.F. Skinner's study of rats in mazes and the whole rewards and punishments thing and so on, it would have been completely different if Skinner had only studied baby monkeys instead of baby rats. Because monkeys are more like us, and we're not like rats in mazes. We are people who thrive on stimulation and newness. So when we say, oh, everything's changing too quickly, and, you know, I wish I could have a bit more stability or certainty in my life, we're fooling ourselves. We're speaking the truth when we say, I really wish, you know, I need a bit more excitement.
Yes. On Life Matters Today, it's Friday Talk Back. We are coming towards the end of it now. My guests, Hugh McKay, we're talking about what makes us tick. Helen, you think Buddhism has something to offer on this?
Oh, yes. As a Buddhist, we have a saying that helps us eliminate suffering associated with desire. It says that desire is the creator, desire is the destroyer, desirelessness is moksha or liberation. And your non-attachment to your desires creates this ability to not get so close to the desire.
But can you actually do it, though? I mean, it sounds very difficult.
Yeah, you can do it, but you have to go through a lot of suffering first to get there, unfortunately. You've got to be prepared for that. I don't think there's any easy way to go there. It's got to be, you know, your desires are made when you're born and they progress through your life, and you're there, you know, eating out those desires as you go along. And once you've eaten out the majority of the negative desires, you're left with the positive ones.
Right, okay. All right. How do you deal with desires like the desire for your place, the desire to be useful? They're the positive ones.
They're the positive ones, but they can be in excess. If you're overly positive in being useful, you're going to get used.
True.
So you step back a little bit so that you're being positively used.
That's a good way to put it, I think, Helen. Thank you very much.
Thank
you. That's Helen in South Australia. We are talking, and let me urge you towards the listener line now, 0283341430, what makes us tick. We've skated a few of these, not as many as I'd hoped, but we can't get to this end of the show and not talk about love, Hugh. It's already been mentioned by one or two callers. You say right at the beginning of the book, you're not going to cover sex, but you do conclude with love.
Mm.
Love's very important, isn't it?
Mm. One of our early callers this morning said that the desire to be loved is more important than the desire to love, and I think I'd take some issue with that. I think these are almost inseparable. I think the desire for love in our lives is about loving as much as it is about being loved.
Mm.
But there is no doubt that our sense of emotional security and even our sense of identity is very dependent upon our capacity to give and receive love. And it's very, very lopsided and can be it can be bizarre if it's more about giving than receiving, or if it's more about receiving than giving. The nature of love is that it's reciprocal. It's rarely unconditional, though in childhood, of course, the luckiest of us do experience unconditional love, and some of us continue to experience it until our parents die. Most of us don't offer each other in adult-to-adult relationships unconditional love, because there's always a condition. If you don't love me, it'll be hard for me to love you.
You said, you know, when we started this, you were talking about the desire to be taken seriously as the probably the most important one. There's got to be an argument about love, though. I mean, it occurs to me you can have, you know, a job that fulfills you, a herd that entertains you and contains you, a place that you call your own. But if there is no love in your life, are you going to be truly... I don't know if you are.
No. Oh, look, you're not going to be fully human unless all of these desires are being satisfied in various ways. But it's love is the last chapter in the book, not by accident.
Mm.
The desire to be taken seriously and the desire for love are like the bookends.
The bookends, yeah.
And I agree with you. I could have done it the other way because I share your view. Love is a transforming experience, whether it's romantic or the love of friendship, the love of family. Without that, I agree with you, absolutely. We can't be said to be fully human. We can't be said to be fulfilled, even if all these other things are happening to us, which is why people who lack love often have a very dark worldview. It does colour everything else. If there isn't enough love in your life, there's no doubt about that.
You spend some time in this chapter recognising the different kinds of love, things like companionate love.
Yes, we're a bit awkward about using this word love. It's one of those things that's got so many meanings. You know, I love cake, I love my dog, I love my wife, I love my kids, I love bark. I don't mean the same thing every time I say those things. So there are many expressions of it.
Cake is obviously the pinnacle.
But no, I mean, companionate love, many marriages evolve into companionate love, where people, I've heard people railing against the sex therapists who want to say to us, no, you know, you've got to pump up your romantic life and recapture the romance of the early years. And, you know, I quote an older man in the book who says, I don't want to hear any of that stuff. You know, we had all that, and what we have now is infinitely better because it's based on absolute trust and familiarity and companionship of a kind we could never have imagined when we were in the throes of romantic passion. So it depends how you define it. I mean, romantic love is, you know, is when we're at our best and our worst, you know, when we feel as though the world is our oyster and everything's rosy and lovely, and where we're cognitively dysfunctional. You know, it's when we're likely to make the poorest judgments, etc., when we're in that very short romantic phase.
Hugh, it's been great having you here today, and I'm glad you've come in. You must feel pleased that it's finished.
Well, it's certainly the toughest of my writing assignments, a book I've wanted to write for about 30 years, and now here it is.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us today.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Richard.
Hugh McKay has been my guest, and his latest book, What Makes Us Tick, The 10 Desires That Drive Us, is published by Hachette. And if you have something to say about what makes you tick, is it usefulness? Is it a desire to find your place? What about the desire for something to happen? What about the desire for love, as we've just been talking about? Make a contribution on the website, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters, or give the listener line a ring, 02 833 1430. Actually, while you're at the website, Vote for Australia's Most Mentally Sexy Dad. We had a problem with the online poll yesterday, but it's fixed now. My thanks to Jackie May, producer, and sound engineer Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. On Monday's show, a controversial health reform you've probably heard nothing about, and one of the most difficult and sensitive issues, how to care for ageing parents. I'm Richard Ady. The Book Show is next, after the news, here on Radio National.
The majority of the people of Israel do accept the notion of a Palestinian state, but we suspect that most Palestinians don't accept the notion of a Jewish state.
Israel has never recognized what the Palestinians have recognized for Israel, which is their right of national self-determination.
The only resolution is for the aspirations of both sides to be met through two states.
A history of the two-state solution. You can download this program from the Radio National website.